Oh no, what episode number is it?
153.
Did you already tell me that?
I did, yeah.
Seriously? Okay. Hello and welcome to episode 153 of Tea or Books. I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
And today, literally just now, we've come up with this topic. We're going to start off by asking the question, do we mind if a non-fiction piece of writing, so most probably a memoir, turns out to have been fabricated in some way after the event or not? And in the second half, we are going to be talking about two books that deal with Alzheimer's. So the first one is When the Cranes Fly South by Liza Ridson, if I got that right.
That's my best guess, yeah.
That's our best guess. And Only About Love by Debbie Voisey. So first of all, Simon, how are you coping in this endless heat wave, and what are you reading?
Oh, it's truly endless. So yes, we apologize. We've both got our windows open in our respective homes because it's too hot not to. But at least I've not got my fan pointed at the microphone. So
yeah.
Thank heavens for small mercies. I am just about coping. It does seem like it's been my entire life this week. People keep throwing around comparisons to 1976, which neither of us remember, but no. perhaps others. I am currently reading Deborah by Esther Kreitman.
Oh.
I think that's right. Because it is Women in Translation Month, which I had forgotten when I suggested, or no, you suggested actually, that we do When the Cranes Fly South. So we are joining in Women in Translation Month inadvertently. And more advertently, I have chosen Deborah by Esther Kreitman, who is the sister of Isaac Singer, but less well known than him. And it was originally written in Yiddish. So it's the first novel I've read that was originally in Yiddish. And it's about, apparently it's very autobiographical, a girl growing up in a Jewish home as the daughter of a rabbi in various places in Poland. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite enjoying it. It's quite like slow and observational, and I'm not entirely sure it's successful in terms of like it goes between different perspectives quite a lot, and I feel like it might be more successful if it had just stuck with Deborah rather than trying to get them all, but that's a choice, I suppose. I think it's going to get more and more interesting as it goes on, because it's a lot of scene setting of like 100 pages of like, what's it like to be the daughter of a rabbi? But she's just got married, and I think that's when things are going to probably get worse, but also maybe more interesting.
And have you found any interesting comparisons between your life growing up as the son of a vicar?
Oh, good question. Definitely the fact that anyone might turn up at your house at any point and expect to like come in and use your home as like a sort of office, or at least or counselling session or something. And the fact that the way that you behave reflects upon how your dad is perceived in the spiritual community. That definitely is true.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting what they choose to translate or not. So they've thrown in some Yiddish. They keep using the word, what is it, tzaddik, which I'd never heard of. And then at one point it said something like tzaddikum, and then it put a footnote and it said plural of tzaddik. And I was like, great.
Doesn't help me.
So, yeah, I assume there's still tzaddiks around. And apologies if I'm mispronouncing Yiddish, but I think it's some sort of like a bishop equivalent, maybe. I don't know. Any Jewish listeners can tell us. How about you? What are you reading?
I've been reading absolutely loads because I'm still on summer holiday. I'm in my seventh week now. Sorry, everyone. It's the one perk of being a teacher, apart from the children, obviously. And I have been reading absolutely tons. First of all, getting through a pile of books that I wanted to get through. But then last weekend, I popped into Waterstones to get Only About Love for today, and got distracted by the Booker Prize longlist display or shortlist display, and then got into conversation with one of the booksellers in my local Waterstones in Bloomsbury, who's lovely, and he was you know, had something wonderful to say about all of them. And then, you know, like when he was sort of there watching me and I felt like I had to get something to say, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to buy. And then I ended up buying two. So I got two of the shortlist, May We Feed the King by Rebecca Perry and Helen of Nowhere by McKenna. I can't remember her last name. I've read both of them already, which is impressive for me, and very much enjoyed them both. Very different. Now, as you and most of our listeners will know, we're not normally ones to be up to date with what's in the current market, and certainly not with the latest prize winners. I normally get to them about 10 years later. So I've enjoyed reading them in kind of partnership with each other. And I've also, Elizabeth Strout, which we've already discussed here, Things We Never Say, is also on the shortlist. And yeah, I really enjoyed May We Feed the King. I think you would enjoy May We Feed the King. It's a really interesting premise. So it's, the narrator is a curator, and her job is to do the displays in historic houses of fake food and so on that make it look like the people who once lived there are still there. And she takes great, or he actually, there's never, we don't know the gender of the curator, and they take their job really seriously. And the story is about, they're asked to go and do a 750th anniversary event at a palace. Nothing is specified. We don't know which country we're in. We don't know anything like that, what time period we're in. And they find in the archives a reference that, again, is never, we're never told exactly what it is, that makes them very emotionally invested in the life of this king. And they want to recreate the king's life as it was and give them respect. And then we go back in time and we hear about the life of this king in the, through the lens of the king. And then we come back into the present day, but we never really find out exactly what happened to the king. And we don't really find out very much about the life of the curator, other than we know that something terrible has happened to them and they've clearly connected to the king in some way. And it's a really interesting meditation, I think, on how much is unknowable about the past and about ourselves, and how much we place of ourselves on the past. And it's beautifully written. Rebecca Perry, I think it's her first novel, but she's a poet. She's published quite a lot of poetry, and it's very poetic and very beautiful. And I started reading it and I thought, I've got no idea where this is going, but I don't mind because I love the language so much. So that's highly recommended. And Helen of Nowhere, I also really enjoyed. It's a kind of take on male sort of entitlement set. It's a male professor, but it's essentially the Odyssey, which I've never actually read, I will confess that. I've not watched the film either and have no plans.
Me neither.
Not really my thing. But I think perhaps if I did know more of the Odyssey, I might have got more from the book. But it's a very interesting book. It's sort of mythological. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but it's a Fitzcarraldo published book. So that kind of tells you what you're sort of getting into, really. But yeah, very much enjoyed it. And I'm actually thinking I might go and explore more of the shortlist as well, because if they're as good as the ones I've read, all as good as the ones I've read, then I think I will enjoy some. That was a very long answer. Sorry.
That's great. And I actually released the last episode, or the latest episode of the podcast, on the day that the list came out. So it looked like we were really on it, being like, look, when the list came out and we're talking about one of the books, but it was very much in the book. I mean, it's very rare that, yes, as you say, that I've read anything on the list. I tend not to have heard of anything on the list, but
I mean, I hadn't really heard of any of them, so there we are, apart from the Elizabeth Strout.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
Yeah. So let's dive into our first topic. Now, I love a conspiracy theory. And I very much enjoy when there's a kind of a drama over a publishing scandal. So I was sort of inspired. Oh, I can hear Hargreaves.
Yes, Hargreeves is getting involved. He loves a conspiracy theory too, apparently.
So. Brilliant. Man after my own heart. So I was saying to you just now how I got really invested in the drama around The Salt Path by Raina Wynne, which isn't actually her real name, as we now know, which was, I don't know how popular it was outside of the UK. I think it was quite popular in the US as well.
Mm.
So for those of you who don't know, The Salt Path is purported to be a memoir of how Rayna Wynn and her husband lost everything. They lost their house in a bad investment, and they had to leave this house and this farm they'd had for years. And at the same time, her husband had also been diagnosed with an incurable degenerative brain condition that meant they didn't know how long he had to live. So they had no money, nowhere to go. And what they decided to do was just to walk the Southwest Coast Path, which is the coastal path that goes around Devon and Cornwall in Britain and is known affectionately as the Salt Path. And so they'd never walked before. They'd done sort of camping holidays and things, but never anything like this. And I mean, they were essentially homeless is the story. And it's as they walk, the story tells of how they kind of meet people who help them on their way. And it's this very sort of uplifting tale about how walking this path also meant that her husband remained healthy and sort of beat the medical odds and so on. And by the end of the book, they've been offered a farm in Cornwall to go and live on, and everything's looking quite rosy. And then she went on to also write a sequel. So I read it and very much enjoyed it, and was quite inspired really by the story. But you haven't read it, have you?
I have not, no.
No. So last year, just as she was about to publish, I think possibly her fourth book, there was an investigative journalist started publishing these articles, basically saying that the whole thing was a fraud. And that they had actually defrauded a friend, which was why that they'd had to give up their house, because they owed so much money, and it wasn't because anyone had done anything to them. They'd also defrauded loads of members of their own family, and there was actually no medical evidence to suggest that the husband had this disease at all. And loads of people then came out of the woodwork to say that, you know, they were both a bunch of grifters essentially, and had been doing this their whole lives, but people hadn't come forward before because she hadn't published under her actual name. And so then there was lots of debate around people getting very upset, largely because they'd been motivated and inspired by the story and finding out it wasn't true, but also they felt that, you know, she was quote unquote a good person who had been sort of fighting against the man and so on, and it turned out that that wasn't true either. And also other people who were suffering from this brain condition, or people who you loved, people who were suffering from that brain condition, had found hope in the idea that perhaps if they, you know, did as much exercise as the husband, or they sort of got out in nature and so on, they might be able to overcome this terrible diagnosis as well. And then there were other people who said, well, you know, we all make up stuff. What does it matter? It's still a good book. And the publishing company, I mean, Penguin, the publishers, said that they had absolutely no responsibility to fact check any of this woman's life. You know, that's not what they do. They trust people to... It's the kind of this idea of, well, it's if as long as it's her truth, then it's okay. So I found that whole debate fascinating, and I'm interested to know what you think about, you know, what do you expect when you read a memoir? Do you want it to be cast iron? Would you be disappointed if you found out it weren't?
Yeah, I will say that even though I have not read The Salt Path, and although I did borrow a copy of it many, many years ago from a friend, and still on my shelves, I was absolutely fascinated by the backlash and by the expose, and read everything I could find about it in that week when it was coming out. And it's, you know, it's not often we get actual controversy in the book world, or at least, you know, the sort of controversy that gets in the newspapers. I lapped it up because I love scandal, apparently.
Don't we all?
But yeah, I think it's a really interesting question to ask, because there's sort of two different types of ways that people can be false in a memoir or in a biography. Mm. One of which is a lie of omission, and one of which is a lie of what's the opposite? Just a
omission, isn't it?
Is it? Okay. So
I've lost my brain because I've been on holiday.
So yeah, people either making something up or just leaving out details. And I think I just read Michael Cunningham's sort of autobiography. It's interesting. It's sort of half an autobiography and half writing advice. And it feels a bit like he was asked to do one of those things. I don't know which one, and merged with the other, but it's brilliant because it's Michael Cunningham. But at some point, quite late in the book, he says, this book is never intentionally false, but is threaded with exaggerations and sometimes invented stories I offer as true.
Oh, I love that.
I thought it was so interesting. Sorry, Huggies is rubbing against the microphone. I'll just read it again because I think it's really interesting. This book is never intentionally false, but is threaded with exaggerations and sometimes invented stories I offer as true. And to the layman, I think a story that is invented is false. But Michael Cunningham's view, and I'm sure the view of many creative writers, is that there is a sort of, not in a like, you know, alternative truth or my truth or something, but a sort of truthfulness in a tone that can be represented by stories that didn't actually happen, but do represent types of stories or something like that. Mm. Which, I mean, obviously when I got to that point and read it, it made me think, what have I read that has not been true in this book? And does it throw into doubt? Because he talks about like being a call boy at one point. He talks about various sort of strange sexual exploits particularly, and there's those parts more than perhaps where he's talking about going on writing retreats or about publication processes that I think was that just fabricated? I don't know. And to an extent that's the sort of like falsity that I can cope with. It's like when you're reading a David Sedaris story, like surely these things are, there'll be a kernel of truth in them, I'm sure, but I'm pretty sure that his essays, which purport to be entirely autobiographical, are very much exaggerated, because no one person has that many things happen to them, surely. Or at least he's very selective in the parts that he includes. But I think it is trickier when it's about a real life illness that affects other people, and you are having this sort of, if you go for a walk, then you'll be cured, because it is that offering false hope thing that does feel quite different. And I can't think of any other examples of books I've read other than things that are written as self-help books that feel ropey around the edges. But maybe that's a bit different from memoir, because you're sort of going in knowing this is the genre I'm reading, these are the liberties people take within this genre. I know from, like, if it has footnotes and case studies and things that are provably true, that I can rely on it. I know if it's a bit more fanciful and woo-woo, then I have to take it with like a pinch of salt, or I have to be willing to go with it. Whereas a memoir where she wasn't writing a memoir saying this is how you get cured, as far as I know, but that is what people might take from it, and that feels more dangerous.
Yeah, and I think you say a lot of interesting things there that I think are worth unpicking. I think anybody who writes a memoir, would say, and I think that there's a lot of truth in that, is that all of us are spinning narrative the whole time. And, the reality is often in our own heads, what's truth and what's fiction can get muddled. Mm. I've certainly had conversations with my siblings where I've been adamant that something happened when we were children, and they'll both say, no, that didn't happen. And they're older than me, and their memories are probably better formed than mine at that age. So I kind of trust them. Or I'll think, oh no, but this happened when we were on this holiday. And, you know, my sister will be like, no, we never went on holiday there. That, you know, we didn't do that at all. And I'm like, okay, where have I got that from then? Mm. But you know, I would have sworn blind that is what happened. So I think sometimes when we are revisiting the past and writing stories about ourselves, we can very easily get caught up in a kind of an idea of what things were like. And I think as long as it's not deliberately mislead, like when you're not doing it to kind of present yourself in a different light or make yourself out to be something extraordinary when you weren't, or whatever, or to cast someone else in a bad light. I'm perfectly happy with that. I think, you know, I don't read memoirs expecting them to be 100% true, because everything's subjective, isn't it? I mean, that's the reality. There is no objective truth when it comes to somebody's life. We're all interpreting the whole time, not just ourselves, but other people as well. But I think there is a kind of, there's also, I think there's that interesting thing of if somebody perceives something about themselves, or kind of wants to use other stories or kind of fabricate things to also perhaps get across the essence of something without actually saying the reality, maybe because it would impinge on someone else's privacy. There has to be a degree of expectation of that when you're reading a memoir. But what I don't like is memoirs like The Salt Path, where it's like, this is about somebody saying that these bad things happened to them and they overcame them by doing this thing. And it presents themselves as being an exceptional person who's had exceptional things happen to them. And if you do these things, then you would be exceptional too. And I think for books like that, that are not written, you know, she's not a famous person writing about her life. She's not, you know, Michael Cunningham giving us an insight into his writing process. This is just some random lady who's decided to write this inspiring book about how she, an ordinary person, can overcome terrible things by doing this wonderful walk. And, you know, that for me, it's like, well, the whole point of this book is that it's marketed as memoir. If it were marketed as a work of fiction, I mean, sure, great, we'll all read it and enjoy it. But the people only bought it because they thought it was true. And I think for me, that's the differentiator. And wasn't there that case in America? And I cannot remember the name of the writer, but I think the book was called A Million Little Pieces or something like that.
Oh,
and
yes.
That turned out to be a fraud. And I remember him going on Oprah Winfrey's show and, you know, the sobbing and apologizing, because I think, again, people had read this book and found great inspiration in it and felt that, you know, they too could overcome their problems and so on. And then it turned out it was a pack of lies.
Yes, I can't remember who it was now, but I read essays by someone who was involved in the publication of it in some way. I try to remember, she worked in, it's gone. It was a very good memoir about, Grief is for People, that's what it was called. But so it was mostly about her friend taking his own life and how that affected her. But it was also partly about her experience of being in the publicity department of the publisher when that all happened. That was interesting. On the memory thing, I really recommend The Memory Illusion by Julia Shaw if you want to absolutely terrify yourself for how you don't actually remember anything that you think you remember. So it's very haunting about like how easy it is to implant false memories and all that sort of thing. That's a lot. I think the flip side of like memoirs that don't tell us everything is a different issue, and something that is perhaps particularly interesting for older memoirs. I remember a while ago asking someone which biography of Rose Macaulay she'd recommend, and there were three: Constance Babington Smith, who was a friend of hers, Jane Emery, who wrote it years later, and then the most recent, Sarah Lefanu, also wrote one, I believe, which I've not read. I've read the other two. And her response was like, always read the most recent because they'll be the most honest. And I was thinking, that's not necessarily what I'm looking for. And I think the one I've enjoyed most was Constance Babington Smith, because she knew Rose Macaulay and could write like she was a friend of hers. And it wasn't, it didn't talk about her affair with that she had at one point, and that was very central to some of the later ones. She had a very long-running affair. It didn't talk about anything that Rose Macaulay probably wouldn't have wanted to talk about. And there seems to be a sense that it's more, well, it is more truthful, but also in somehow more authentic to write things the author wouldn't, or the subject of the biography wouldn't want you to write about. And there's lots of books where they don't, you know, memoirs from the past where they don't talk about affairs, or they don't talk about the author's sexuality, or they don't talk about any number of things that the author deliberately kept private for whatever reason during their life. And I think I definitely prefer a book by someone who knows a subject and can write a very subjective version of their life, but it's a subjective version based on firsthand knowledge, rather than, as you say, any biography or memoir is going to be subjective. But it's that attempt, or masquerade of objectivity that says, oh, we have to reveal all these unpleasant things. And I don't need that.
Yeah, and I think with biography as well, as opposed to memoir, there's that filter, isn't there? And this idea that I'm being objective, I'm telling you everything there is to know about this person. Well, of course you can't. You know, you're not writing a 5,000 page long book that's going to cover absolutely everything that ever happened to this person. You know, you're making subjective selections based on what you think is interesting about that person's life, and also what you think other people will find interesting about that person's life. And the fact that they had an affair, or, you know, they were shagging their way around half of London or whatever at the time, I mean, that might not actually have been very important to that person's perception of themselves at all. Mm. But it's salacious and it's, you know, makes it sexy, and that's what people want to read. And it's like, well, actually, you know, great, but that's just another filter that you're laying over that person's lives. And I think, I mean, memoir is obviously different because, you know, you're choosing to write it and you're making those selections yourself as opposed to having someone else do it for you. And I'm just thinking actually about, for example, I know that you really love the work of Beverly Nichols and his writing about his relationship with houses and gardens and so on. And they're very lighthearted and they're very funny and so on. And you read those books imagining that he's had this, you know, wonderful bucolic life, just, you know, lots of fun and games. But actually, it's a much more complex life than that. But he chooses to skim over all of that because that's not what he wants to explore. It's the same with Diary of a Provincial Lady, which, you know, we both love. Mm. I mean, obviously very autobiographical. But if you read between the lines, you can see quite clearly she was... her marriage obviously wasn't great, but, you know, that's skimmed over and it's all lots of fun. The same with Mrs. Miniver by Jan Struther. You know, you find out after reading it that actually the marriage was not great and they did end up splitting up, but you wouldn't know that from reading the book because she wants to present her life as a kind of idyll, I suppose, perhaps for herself as much as for anybody else. So I think it's, you know, I think it's complex, isn't it? And I certainly, after reading books like that, like I remember after reading Mrs. Miniver, I absolutely loved it and I wanted to look up Jan Struther. I know she doesn't call it, you know, Mrs. Struther, but, you know it's supposed to be her. And I was just devastated when I found out the reality of her life. And it did kind of spoil it for me and I wish I hadn't. But then I wouldn't have wanted to read it if it had been truthful because I enjoyed it for what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I found similarly with Elizabeth von Arnim's, it's not quite an autobiography, but she wrote All the Dogs of My Life, which is the nearest she did, although, of course, Elizabeth series is also autobiographical. And yeah, she does sort of allude to the fact that her marriages weren't happy, but definitely not to the extent that, you know, the reality of them, those other biographies have talked about. And similarly, I've not actually read the biography, but I know Joan Bodger wrote this wonderful book called How the Heather Looks, which is American family, her family, who are American, going around the UK and visiting the sites of famous children's books. And it's very beautiful and nostalgic and all that sort of thing. But the biography, I think, I can't remember if it's now, if it's a biography or autobiography, it's called The Crack in the Teapot. And it is about, Crack in the Teacup. It's right by me. Let's find out. Bodger. The Crack in the Teacup. And it's a biography by... Well, no, it's an autobiography of Joan Bodger. From my understanding of it, that, you know, the version of herself that she showed in that book was very much edited. And it's one of those books I thought, as soon as I read How the Heather Looks, I must get hold of it. I ordered it straight away in 2013. Yet to read it, so one day.
You'll get there eventually.
And yeah, I think Muriel Spark's autobiography, Curriculum Vitae, is notorious for not telling very much of the truth about anything. But that's Muriel Spark for you, isn't it?
Well,
you
wouldn't
expect it.
And I don't think I'd enjoy it if it did. It needs to be, you know, I'd want it to be in her true style.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when sometimes I think people didn't tell the truth because they didn't realise it. Like I recently read Letters to Gwen John by Celia Paul, which talks about Gwen John, but also talks about her own relationship with Lucian Freud, whom she started a relationship with when he was 55 and she was 18. And I think she's still quite like, she just doesn't seem to realize how much he manipulated her. And I just don't think there can be a non-abusive version of that relationship. So
think people are often blind to things like that, aren't they?
Yeah. So obviously that's very forgivable from a memoirist, but it's still interesting. Like what counts as being honest when you don't, you know, because people are not that clear-sighted about their own lives.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tricky, isn't it? I think if you read anything expecting to read the truth, then you're onto a dodgy wicket. But I think, I do think that when things are marketed as truth, then that they should be based in that and with the intention of truth anyway.
And that is interesting, the point you raised about fact-checking and how publishers just don't do that anymore because they don't have the budget for it. And it's very easy to pass the buck. But do you think there is a moral duty to a publisher to do proof check, to fact-checking?
I actually think there is. And I found that very interesting when the whole ThoughtPath debacle was being played out in the news and the publisher were very busy, abdicating themselves of all responsibility. And I did think to myself, well, hang on a second. If someone had come to me with a story like this that hinges on a miraculous medical story, for starters, I would want to check that bit out, because you are essentially, even though she's not saying in so many words, if you do this, you'll get cured, people could feasibly take that from it. It's a bit like the Advertising Standards Authority, isn't it? It's like adverts get withdrawn if they imply that if you do this, you do this. And I feel like that book was very much implying that. And with things like that, I do think that the publisher has a duty to be like, well, hang on a second. I want to know what I want to get a doctor's opinion on this. I want to see some evidence. If people are claiming things to be true and they sound a bit unrealistic, then I think that somebody should be checking these things before things get published, because I think it's misleading and it misleads the public. If it were published in a newspaper, then people would be rightfully, very upset, and the newspaper would have to publish a retraction. But when it comes to a book, that doesn't seem to happen. And I think there's perhaps too much. I mean, I remember Penguin saying at the time, we trust people when they're writing about their own lives to write the truth. It's like, well, you can't do that, can you?
Yeah, and they would definitely fact check if they were worried about being sued for libel. So they'd find the budget for that, I'm sure.
I mean, for example, if you were writing something and you made claims about, I had a baby with this celebrity, but it's a secret or whatever. I mean, you wouldn't be able to publish that without checking it, would you?
No, exactly.
So where do you draw the line? I wonder if we've got any listeners who are involved in this sort of thing. If they could, enlighten us. I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, have you had children with celebrities?
No, not that.
Oh dear. So what do you think? Do you want your non-fiction to be fully truthful?
Yes, if it's a kind of book based on an ordinary person's story, yes. If it's a famous person, I don't mind as much. And by famous, I mean like writer, artist, whatever, as well as, natural celebrity. For example, I loved Prince Harry's memoir, Spare. I didn't expect any of it to be truthful. I just enjoyed it for the laughs. So it's, you have different expectations for different types of text. But ultimately, if you're making claims about things that need to be truthful, I think, yes, I expect it to be truthful.
Yeah, I think I'm going to, on balance, come down on, I'm not too worried. But I think there are those exceptions. But I think on balance, I'm going to be I expect a bit of fabrication and exaggeration.
Yeah, we all do it.
We all do it.
Yeah.
We have a question from Jane for the middle. Thank you, Jane. Sending questions to tallbooks@gmail.com. She says, if you could only read books from one country for the next 6 months, obviously in translation for non-English countries, which country would you choose? And you can't say the UK or Canada.
Oh, that's a very good question. Okay. So I'd probably use this as an opportunity to broaden my reading.
Okay.
And to explore a culture that I don't know as much about. So I think, the country that's just come into my head out of nowhere is I would read books from Egypt.
Ooh.
I don't think I've ever read a book about written by an Egyptian person about Egypt. So there we are.
There you go, wow. Any reason?
I mean, I've always loved the idea of Egypt, the history, the culture. But I think, it's obviously a country that's gone through a lot of turmoil, particularly in recent years. And there's a really rich history and culture that I, would like to learn more about. So beyond the mummies and the pharaohs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a couple answers I'm going to try. So one is sort of cheating because part of me wants to say like France, so that it's the only way I'm ever going to read Proust is if I just like sort of force myself into it. But for more variety, I think I'm going to say Hungary because I've only read like 3 or 4 books by Hungarians and they've all been brilliant. So I'm like, what's going on in Hungary? Clearly, they've got an excellent literary culture. So I need to find out more and read some more Hungarians.
Well, I can highly recommend, actually. I can't see it on my shelf. Where is it? I'll have to tell you afterwards.
Okay.
I can't see the spine. But it was a really good book I bought in Budapest and absolutely loved it. And it was kind of crazy and very Hungarian in the way that I expected. But I'll have to text you afterwards.
Intriguing. Well, yeah. If I'll add that note somewhere in the blog, stuckinabook.com if we get the deets on what that is. Thank you, Jane. So now, yeah, they're going to do 2 novels, as you say, about men with Alzheimer's or dementia, some variety. Only About Love by Debbie Voisey and When the Cranes Fly South by Liza Ridson, translated by Alice Mingus. Are you happy to introduce us to Only About Love?
Yes, I mean, I literally just read it a couple of hours ago. So I think I'm right in saying this. It's defined as works of flash fiction. So it's kind of a strung together selection of pieces of flash fiction, because that's what Debbie Voisey does. And you get these snapshots of the life of Frank, largely told through the eyes of his daughter, but also through the eyes of his son in moments, and also some from him himself. So, and there's also some from his wife. There's not really a kind of, you know, logic to it in that sense. And it basically tells the story of this man's life from when he was a child up to him being in a home dying from Alzheimer's. And you, in these moments, these glimpses, you see the man that he was, the marriage he had, the failures that he had through his life. You know, he wasn't very faithful to his wife, and his relationship with his children, how his children feel about him, and his relationship with his own father, who was a traumatized World War II soldier. So it was really interesting, actually. It's a really interesting structure because it's not a kind of linear, logical story. I mean, obviously the story is it's his life, and you know he's gonna be having he has Alzheimer's because that keeps getting dropped in, but it's not a chronological story in any way. So, and it's only 100 pages or so. It's very short.
Yeah. And When the Cranes Fly South is narrated by a man called Beau, almost entirely by a man called Beau, who is addressing his wife Frederica, but she has got much more advanced dementia, and she is in a facility, I guess, I don't know what the proper word is, but you know, it's around the clock care, and she doesn't remember who anyone is, and Beau largely doesn't go and see her. And he has got earlier signs of dementia, and he is has carers who come every day, but not who don't live in. And between chapters, there are their notes, and sometimes his son Hans notes as well, like you know, what his mood is feeling, or if they've given him food, or if he's been willing to shower, and all that sort of thing. And a large part of the novel is the fact that his son Hans wants to take his dog Sixton away from him because he doesn't think he can care for the dog anymore. And there's also his friendship with a man called Torre, who they've known many, many, many years. And Haku's being very noisy. I have to move him at some point. Yes, I'm talking about dogs. So we see it through his eyes, and it's it does go back to his own childhood as well. It goes back to when Hans was younger, a young child as well. So it's flashbacks, but not, they're more like in Beau's memory rather than the narrative, flashing back to them. Yeah.
Okay. So what did you think of When the Cranes Fly South? You're having a lot of translation going on right now.
Well, I know, yes, Women in Translation Month. I enjoyed it a lot, actually. I was slightly skeptical just because I knew how popular it had been, and it'd been, you know, I think a lot of people read it after Richard Osman talked about it quite a lot. And I'm always slightly skeptical about the books that do super, super well. But I thought the thing I actually liked most about it was the friendship with Torre. And we've often talked about how adult friendships, and maybe particularly male adult friendships, are not talked about a lot in novels. And it was really beautiful. And Torre has this secret that I won't reveal, but there's just a lot of tolerance and love between the two. And he's very happy to talk about how much he loves him. You know, it's not saying it to Torre's face, he's saying it in his own narrative. But I thought it was really moving that it's clear that Torre is on par with his wife and child as the most, and his dog, as the most significant relationships in his life. And I thought she did that really beautifully. So yeah, it felt, it was very like honest book, as he does not skirt around you know, the loss of bodily functions and those sorts of things, but nor do I think it did them too gratuitously. But yeah, yeah. I found it very immersive. I felt really very interesting voice, very believable character, and I think it's very good. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I had the same reservations before reading it, because I was like, oh, this is one of, you know, everybody's reading this. I mean, how good can it be? And I was really quite blown away by it. I'd not read a book from the perspective of somebody, you know, at the end of their life and knowing that they're at the end of their life before. And I think it was really a kind of a necessary book, actually, in order to explore how challenging it is to be at that stage of life where you feel like you no longer have agency, you no longer have choices. And I think it was a really clever plot device where she kind of builds it around the fact that the son wants to take his dog away, because that's like his companion, and he takes such joy in that dog, and his frustration and his anger, and gradually he's having to accept that actually I'm not allowed to make this choice for myself anymore. I'm powerless in this decision. You know, like there's literally nothing I can do about it. If my son decides that he's going to take the dog away, I have to accept that. And it's like he's going back to being a child. And I think she explores that emotional kind of the emotions connected with that realization of the gradual erosion of self that can happen with extreme old age really beautifully. I mean, obviously I've not experienced it myself, so I don't know what it feels like, but it felt to me very authentic. And I know that the author was basing it on, I think her father, her father's experiences, and it felt very true in that sense. And I also absolutely loved the male friendship as well. I'm really glad that you mentioned that. I thought that was a beautiful element of the book. I thought the fact that he was also living with this kind of secret life, and a secret life that he'd never fully shared with Bo either. And that realization, when somebody has died, you can think that you are incredibly close to someone, you can think that you've shared a life together, and then realize, oh, there was this whole part of that person that was hidden from me the whole time. I found that really interesting. And then I was like, I want a book about Torre now.
Maybe we'll get one. Yeah,
but I mean, I think we should shout out if Lisa is listening. We'd all really like that book. And I also really loved the relationship with the carers, and also seeing the role of the carers and how much carers do, and showing how necessary people who do work in those caring roles, who are often overlooked and underpaid, are to enabling people to have independence and to also remain in their own homes for as long as possible. Because for him, being in his own space and being surrounded by his things is 100% essential to his well-being. And the fact that he is able to continue to have that comfort, even if he can't have his dog, through having those carers. And we see as well, you know, they're always rushing around, sometimes they don't have time to do things and they've got to go to the next person and so on. I think her portrayal of that element of elderly life was also really powerful and interesting, and also interesting to see that, you know, it's not just an issue we have here in the UK. I mean, there's clearly also an issue in Sweden to find people to be able to do this work.
Yeah, and by contrast, Only About Love is much more external view, so it's not narrated by Frank, and we see, as you say, these snapshots across from, well, some of it's from his perspective, but lots of it's from other people's perspective. And I found that actually it was quite disorienting, that you go between these things and not know quite when you were or who was talking.
Yes.
And quickly worked it out, but I thought that worked well in context because you were just a little hint of the disorientation that Frank feels at different times in the narrative. I thought it came together really interesting. I thought you built together this picture of this man who has so many flaws, but you get to understand them, if not necessarily forgive them. He has many affairs, but you sort of see that he's just desperate for love. I thought the way we see him as a child, and then we see his children, and then we see his children when they've taken on more of a caring role, in such a short book, really complex about those sorts of relationships. And the title comes from something quite late in the book where his daughter, Dawn, is shaving him. And I won't read it all, but it says towards the end, each touch of your fingers on his skin reminds him that love still exists. You want all his waking thoughts from now on to be only about love. And, you know, I thought it's very moving about that, and very moving about how to have a relationship with somebody who's much further past where Beau is, and I guess near where Frederica is, where they don't know who you are and they are not behaving like themselves or rationally or responsibly, and how to still have a loving relationship. I thought very powerful, but
yeah, I mean, I was cursing you today, sitting on my balcony trying to have a nice time reading this book, and I was just like, oh, this is awful, I'm so sad. I actually was really impressed with the book, because we get so much information in so little, you know, word count, really. And what I really enjoyed is the fact that she just trusts the reader to make the connections. You know, you're making these enormous leaps between each of these flashes of moments in time, and you're having to do a lot of work as the reader, a lot of imaginative work to fill in those gaps. And, you know, but the reality is, I think you don't actually need that much information. We find there's, like, I think two little moments where we learn that his father was one of the soldiers who liberated Bergen-Belsen, and when he came back he was a different person, and he force-fed his children and was abusive towards them because he couldn't cope with what he'd seen. And, you know, it's like, okay, that's all I need to know. I can imagine what his childhood was like then, and I can imagine how that's impacted on him as an adult, and why he behaves in the way that he does. He's never been shown love, of course he's going to behave like this. So I think it's a real lesson as well in economy, and how much you can trust a reader to make those connections themselves without needing reams and reams and reams of description of some traumatized childhood. And I really like you say, that kind of disorientation, because we are being invited into this headspace where, you know, actually, who are these people and what time is it? And, you know, did this really happen? Which I thought was really clever, you know, on a meta narrative level. I for some reason, I didn't dislike him at all either. Even, you know, what he put his wife through and the children through, and he kept leaving, and you think, gosh, what an awful thing that's happened to the children. But the fact that his children still love him so much, I thought it was a really beautiful exploration of how we are able as individuals to kind of forgive each other and understand, especially as you grow into an adult yourself, you see your parents not as your parents, but just other adults like you who are just figuring out as they go along.
Yeah, and I really loved the father-son relationship in When the Cranes Fly South as well, for being so nuanced. I thought it was really funny that, you know, unlike the usual thing we hear of the younger generation being much more left-wing and reactionary, that Hans comes home as a teenager and says, you know, social liberalism hasn't worked, I'm all conservative now, and just went the other way around. It reminded me actually a lot of their relationship. I read this really good Canadian novel whilst I was in Canada called The Book of Eve by Constance Beresford Howe, which I think is quite well known in Canada and not very well known outside, about this woman who, I think she's in her 60s, but it was written in the 70s, 80s. So, like, you know, that was felt older then than it does now, I suspect.
Yeah.
And she decides to leave her marriage, even though, you know, there's no obvious reason for it, and she goes and lives on her own, and she's got a son who's very like Hans in some ways, who is trying to take on the caring role and trying to persuade her to do the right thing, but she's got no dementia or anything, so she's just like, no, I'm fine. And it is that thing, like, his illness means that he, as you say, like, all all children, as they get older, start having some more caring responsibility for their parents, if that when their parents are very old. But it's gone further here, where he just is not allowed to make decisions anymore, and it and his sort of dealing with that. And yeah, as you say, I think focalizing that through the decision about the dog is in some ways quite manipulative emotionally, because that's obviously going to get pluck at the heartstrings. But it is, yeah, I guess representative of so much in his life that he can no longer control.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're right. I really enjoyed the complexity of the relationship between father and son, and how much they can't communicate with each other, just like his father wasn't able to communicate with him. And I think that exploration of male relationships and the challenges of male relationships, as opposed to the easy relationship that Hans has with his mother, is, I think, a really interesting thing to explore. And I mean, it's interesting, again, you've got two books here that we've read written by women with male protagonists, exploring male emotions through a female lens. I think that's really interesting. I mean, I'd be interested to know, you know, how would these books have been if they'd been written by men? There be the same focus? Would there be the same would they have explored it in similar or different ways? We'll never know. But I think they're both really interesting in the sense that, you know, they purport to be about somebody who's at the end of their life and what it's like being about being at the end of your life, but they're actually so much more to it than that, about relationships and forgiveness and regrets, and also in some ways like the discussion that we've just been having. I mean, how you present yourself and how much truth that you allow people to know about you and your life, what people know about you from the outside, who knows, you know, his friend's children don't fully understand him or what he's done, or who, you know, the person that he is outside of what he tells them or what their mothers told them. And it's the same with Tora, you know, like he has got whole parts of his life that he doesn't tell other people. And, you know, why do we do that? What motivates us to do that? I think those are really interesting questions. So it's a lot of complexity in both of them, actually, and impressively so in Only About Love, considering how short it is.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is. Yeah, it's quite impressionistic in a way, or synecdochal maybe. Anyway, yeah, that it we, as you say, can infer so much from so little, whereas the other one is a bit more detailed and a bit more like day-to-day life.
And chronological as well, which
much
more traditional in its format.
And you can sort of sense occasionally based on the notes or things that happen, the things that he's not remembering or the things that he is losing track of, whereas I guess with Frank, because we build him up so much as the person, the man he was, then when you see the man he is in the current day, it is...
it's devastating. Yeah. I mean, I was sobbing. Yeah, you did that to me.
Blame Debbie. I don't know how much I've written beside this, but I'm assuming maybe this is Lisa's first book. She's younger than us, I think, so it's impressive that she's able to get into the mind of a...
Well, many people are now. We're old.
So. Well, true, yeah. It's no longer a novel thing. Okay, so it's her debut novel, 2024. I don't know if she's had any others after that, but yeah, I'm sure. Sure there'll be more. Oh, and there's a film coming out. There you go.
Yes.
Right, well, what are you going to pick?
This is genuinely a very challenging choice, because I did very much enjoy both of them, and I do think they're both very good in their own ways. But I think actually I'm going to go for Only About Love because of the brevity and how impressive it is to build that emotional world in the constraints of the word count, and also that flash fiction form.
Yeah, great. I also find this one quite tricky. I think I'm going to lean slightly towards When the Cranes Fly South, just because, I guess, because of the format it gives you the chance to just delve into those relationships a bit more. Both really interesting books. And in the next episode we will be doing two Virginia Woolf novels, Jacob's Room and The Waves.
Looking forward to it. I've not read any Virginia Woolf for a while, actually.
Be fun. We'll see you then. You can see all the books and authors mentioned at stuckinabook.com. You can get in touch at tyourbooks@gmail.com, and you can find Rachel at booksnob.substack.com.
Bye. Thanks very much for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.